Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has had extraordinary experience, not just trying to make sense of the war for the free world, but actually wage it in senior positions in the United States government, is our first guest. He is Douglas J. Feith. He served under George W. Bush as the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2001 to 2005. This was the latest of a number of other positions in the government, in the Defense Department, where we actually served together, and also in the National Security Council under President Ronald Reagan. His latest book is War and Decision, Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. It is the definitive text, as far as I'm concerned, on much of what transpired during the period Doug was working in the Pentagon, both during 9/11 and in the months and years that followed. He is an extraordinary resource, a good friend, and a mentor. We're delighted to have him with us for two segments, I'm very pleased to say. Doug Feith, welcome back. It's great to have you.
Happy to talk to you, as always.
Well, there's much going on in the world, and by virtue of the fact that, as I'm fond of saying, you had the whole world in your portfolio, let me pick your brains about a couple of important developments. They seem to have as sort of a common denominator, at least many of them, the result of democracy at work. Just yesterday, the German people went to the polls, and they've reelected Angela Merkel as their chancellor, but with a new entrant on the field, the Alliance for Deutschland, as it's called. Talk a little bit about what you make of this electoral outcome, Doug, and your anticipation as to what will be the policy implications of it for NATO, for the European Union, for the U.S.-German relationship, among other things.
Well, I think that the election results in Germany are disturbing in that this new party that's coming in with around 13%, this Alliance for Germany, as it's called, has people in it who've made some very extreme right-wing statements. And I think one of the lessons that this election may be teaching is there is a strong desire on the part of a lot of people in Europe for some kind of nationalism and national pride.
This may be what Donald Trump was referring to when he was talking about sovereignty at the UN last week.
Yeah, I think you see certain parallels in the United States, too, in the support for Trump, where in some ways it's a reaction, I think, to some of the same thinking that you have, that you saw in the Obama administration and that you see in more intellectual circles in Europe, where there's a desire for supranational government, a rejection of national or ethnic pride.
Notably in the European Union, as Angela Merkel has been a champion of it.
And I think that what you have in kind of intellectual circles is not really in tune with what a lot of people, ordinary people in Europe feel, which is I think that a lot of people in Europe are happy to, you know, try to make arrangements that will make war less likely, which was, I think, a large part of the motive for the European Union. But they don't want to transcend, leave behind, abandon their ethnicity, their national pride in the process. And if the people who believe in kind of basic liberal democratic principles are unwilling to embrace a kind of healthy, non-bigoted nationalism, then what happens is they're basically abandoning the field, they're forfeiting in favor of extremist groups who raise the banner of nationalism. And so I think that there's a lesson here that that if the only choice that people are given in the polls is a kind of bigoted nationalism or a kind of progressive, you know, rejection of all national pride and national identity, then you're going to wind up with an increase in the power of the bigots, because they're going to benefit from the desire of a lot of people to have some kind of recognition of national pride and ethnic identity. And I don't think it follows that nationalism has to be extreme and bigoted, but it's going to be important for the parties in the center to come up with some way of reconciling their views with a healthy kind of nationalism.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I'm not sure that we're going to have all that much agreement, certainly with coming guests, on this question of how extreme the AFD is, but we'll be talking it through for sure. And I think your point is well taken, that when confronted particularly with the infusion of vast numbers of people who don't share any of those national sentiments, pride, attachment to, you know, the culture and the rest, that there is going to have to be some acknowledgement that those who do have the sentiments are not being ignored. And that seems to have been pretty much the case under Angela Merkel. Doug, let me turn to another area of the world that you have been very much focused on for a long time. Today, the Kurds of Iraq are holding a referendum that is, I think, intended to help them extricate themselves from that country. What are your thoughts on what they're doing and what it is likely to result in?
Well, the Kurds are, I believe, the largest national group. I mean, a group with their own language, their own history and traditions, the largest ethnic group in the world that doesn't have their own state. And they have been divided among a number of countries: Iran, Iraq, Syria, and Turkey. And they had some hopes after World War I that the peace conference would provide them with a state, but the peace conference didn't provide them with a state. It divided them among those four countries, and what has happened in recent years is they have pulled together enough sentiment in the based in the area in northern Iraq where they long had autonomy under American protection. They've pulled together enough people who say, you know, now is the time, with the disintegration of Syria, with the collapse of any kind of peace process with the Turkish government, with the collapse of central control in Iraq, and the rise of ISIS, which for a while took over a large part of Kurdish territory, and is now in the process of being liberated from ISIS,
with the infusion of Shiites, notably under the influence of Iran, it would seem.
Right, with all of these major developments going on in the region, there you now have a referendum where a number of Kurds think that this is the moment, this is the historical moment when they can and should assert separate national identity for the Kurds.
Get out while the getting's good. Doug, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, we'll be talking at greater length with Douglas Feith about what that policy choice may mean, notably for Turkey, a country in which he has been very knowledgeable for a long time and that is increasingly at the forefront of our concerns in this region. That and more with Douglas J. Feith, the author of War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are talking with Douglas J. Feith, the former Undersecretary of Defense in the George W. Bush administration, the author among many, many articles and op-eds of a terrific book, War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. And Doug, before the break, we were talking about the Kurds seeing a window of opportunity. They are expected, I think, to approve overwhelmingly this referendum. Not clear that the government in Baghdad is going to cotton to it, but there's also an awful lot of other places in the region that aren't terribly keen on seeing a homeland of any kind for the Kurds. So walk us through what you think comes next.
Well, I think if the referendum passes as it's anticipated that it will, there's going to be an outcry from Turkey in particular, but also Iraq and Iran. The Syrian government would also protest, I assume, but I can't imagine there'll be that much attention paid to what Assad says. But even so, there'll be a strong outcry, and especially from Turkey, against the idea of Kurdish sovereignty. The Turks fear that if there's an independent Kurdistan, even if it's located in northern Iraq and maybe with a piece of the Kurdish area of Syria included, the Turks fear that there will then be claims that the Kurdish-speaking regions of Turkey should be united with this independent Kurdistan. That's why the Turks have been, for a very long time, passionate opponents of any kind of Kurdish sovereignty.
And there are large areas of Turkey where there is a substantial Kurdish population. Is that correct?
Right. For many years, as the Turks were working on developing their Turkish national identity for the Republic of Turkey, they worked, governments over a long time, worked very hard to try to cultivate the idea that all Turkish citizens should think of themselves as Turkish citizens rather than as Kurds. And there were some strong oppressive measures taken to eliminate Kurdish identity and to try to suppress Kurdish language.
Doug, I'd like this response to the Kurdish referendum. Let's broaden the lens a little bit, if we can, to talk about where Turkey is headed under Recep Tayyip Erdogan. You have, again, been deeply involved both in government and outside of it in the challenges that Turkey faces and that we face from Turkey at the moment. I'm interested in your thoughts about whether the Islamization of the country under Erdogan, now greatly facilitated by the concentration of power that he currently enjoys, is making the Turks less and less of a reliable ally to our country and, for that matter, to NATO.
I do think it is making them a less reliable ally, and it's calling the premises of the U.S. relationship with Turkey into question. I mean, for years, the two main premises of our relationship with Turkey were that Turkey is a fellow democracy, and second, that we shared important national security interests. And what Erdogan has done with Turkey is he has systematically dismantled Turkey's democratic institutions. And it's not at all clear that it's proper to even call Turkey a democracy anymore. He's been vicious in imprisoning journalists and imprisoning his political opponents, making false charges against them.
And really fomenting an anti-Americanism as well that is now quite virulent, is it not?
Right. So first of all, I think he's been systematically destroying the institutions of Turkish democracy. And then secondly, he's been agitating for policies that are hostile to the United States. And he's been specifically, as you just said, agitating for hostility against the United States. And so both of these major premises of our relationship with Turkey for decades, he has undermined. It's a deeply disturbing development.
Indeed. You were talking earlier in the program about the impact of refugees on the German polity. Many of them came from, or at least came through, or were facilitated in their transit by the Turks. This seems to be increasingly seen, I think properly, as a hostile act on the part of the Turks, and they seem to be threatening to do more of it if they don't get their way. Doug Feith, you spent a lot of time in government, and again, as an analyst now with the Hudson Institute, where you direct the Center for National Security Strategies, thinking through NATO and how it needs to adapt to changed environments, including, of course, not least the Russians, who were the initial impetus for it. But it's been pointed out that if the Turks are no longer really an ally, what are we doing allowing them to continue to have access to our councils in NATO, to intelligence, to militarily relevant technology, and other secrets. Yet people point out that there's no way to formally remove a fallen ally, shall we say, from NATO. What are your thoughts on the way ahead there?
Well, it is a really serious challenge to NATO to try to deal with the question of how do you deal with an ally that is not democratic and not aligned with the basic strategic interests that are shared among all the rest of the NATO countries. I mean, one way to think about it is the term international community gets used very often, or the world community, but the world is not a community. NATO has been an authentic community, which is to say, a group of countries that actually share principles. And the shared principles are really essential to the NATO operation. I mean, NATO has been pursuing policies, security policies for Europe, that stand on a foundation of shared principles. And the policies reflect the shared principles. What you have with Erdogan is he's putting Turkey in a position where it's repudiating, it's rejecting those principles that are the shared principles of the alliance. And it's not at all clear that you can sustain the alliance with Turkey when the Turkish government is outspoken in opposition to the basic principles of the alliance.
Yeah, downright hostile. So, Doug, what would you recommend in terms of removing this thorn from their side?
Well, I'm not sure that I have kind of the command of all the relevant considerations, you know, up to date that would allow me to make a specific policy prescription. But I would say that this is a challenge that NATO needs to deal with. It needs to take seriously the idea of community, and community is a matter of how countries identify. And if the Turks stop identifying as a member of the Western liberal democratic community of states, then they really don't have a place any longer in the alliance, and they're not reliable. And changes are going to have to be made. Now, how you do that, do you do that all at once? Do you do that based on a suspension or an expulsion? I mean, those are complicated questions that I would think the U.S. officials would want to be consulting with our NATO allies about.
Yeah, and they better be about it indeed. Doug Feith, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I appreciate so much your time, these very, very interesting insights into challenges that we're facing in critically important parts of the world. As always, these insights are welcome. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, thank you for the work you're doing at the Hudson Institute. And of course, again, folks, I commend to you War and Decision: Inside the Pentagon at the Dawn of the War on Terrorism. Doug, we'll talk with you again soon. Next up, we'll talk with Claire Lopez. We'll visit with her about, among other things, Iran. What's going on? Will the president decertify the JCPOA? That and more straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. I'm pleased to say, joined by my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, Claire Lopez, our Vice President for Research and Analysis. She is a longtime specialist in, well, various aspects of the war for the free world, including roughly 20 years of service as an operations officer in the Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine service. In the course of which she served in a number of garden spots of the universe and knows a lot about the kinds of challenges that we have been facing for some time in various parts of the planet. It is a pleasure to have her back as one of the go-to resources for us at the Center for Security Policy on so many issues involving particularly the global Islamic movement, as it calls itself, and Sharia supremacism. We'll be talking with her about that and much more in the course of two segments. Claire, it's so good to have you back. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Frank. I'm glad to be with you again.
Let me start by asking you about a subject that you've really been a duty expert on for not just those of us here at the center, but I think for people in this country and across the world, namely Iran. Claire, we have been treated to a sort of ongoing internal turmoil in the Trump administration with respect to what I think of as the Obama bomb deal. What is your current reading, Claire, as to the president's view on this? He says he's made up his mind about it, but he hasn't shared with us to date what he will do. What's your betting?
Well, I think that he has indicated in various speeches, certainly at the United Nations, but also prior and to that and since then, that he really does not want to recertify Iran as compliant with the so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, or the nuclear deal with Iran, when that next due date comes up in the middle of October. So I'm expecting that he will not recertify.
And there's talk within his official circle that he may not recertify, but he may not actually withdraw from this agreement, that somehow he would seek to negotiate it from inside. Is that a practicable idea, let alone a good one, Claire Lopez?
No, I don't think so at all. And I certainly hope that's not the course he decides to take. There are so many reasons why Iran is not compliant, is in fact in material breach of this deal. As a matter of fact, our colleague and friend at the center here, Fred Flights, has written about many of these breaches at the National Review Online. And I myself also wrote a piece not long ago outlining exactly how Iran is violating the deal.
Give us some examples, if you would, Claire, because I think this is so material to what the president's being asked to do.
Well, certainly, for example, the way the Iranians have been sort of flirting with some of the specific provisions of the deal that Fred, for example, has pointed out, overproducing heavy water, for example. And now we read that they have probably produced more centrifuges than they were allowed to, but because many of them broke, they sort of in a way stayed within the limits, but not on purpose. But the most important reason why the president should not recertify this Iran deal, nuclear deal, is that Iran has had a clandestine nuclear weapons program since the late 1980s. It has never not had a clandestine nuclear weapons program. It continues to this day. These provisions of the JCPOA, in particular a section called Section T, absolutely get at the breaches, plural, that Iran is involved in all kinds of activities, unfortunately too many of them hidden.
Yeah, that goes to the heart of the question, because we're often told by promoters of this deal that it has the most intrusive on-site inspection regimen in history. And Claire Lopez, what you just said there is so critical, that there are military installations on which this kind of activity is taking place, including deeply buried underground facilities, that the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, is not actually inspecting at all. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. Primary among these, I would name a place called Parchin. And this is a military base under the control of the Iranian Department of Defense, where it's been publicly demonstrated Iran continues a clandestine nuclear weapons program, including work, R&D work, research and development work on warheads, as well as the triggers to set off the warhead explosions. But because that is off base to IAEA inspectors, and there is absolutely nothing in the JCPOA that actually obligates Iran to open any place it doesn't feel like opening, only it provides a long, drawn-out process for requests to be made. Because of that, no inspectors are allowed and have been inside of Parchin.
So we can only speculate on what's going on in those facilities, but there's every reason to believe, based on what we are seeing, what we have been able to ascertain, that there's more illegal activity going on there. All the more reason why the president should neither recertify compliance on the Iranians' part nor continue to allow us to be bound by this agreement. Claire Lopez, let me switch gears if I could, please. The president has, speaking of Iran, modified somewhat the arrangements by which he is precluding or at least restricting immigration from countries like Iran. In fact, he added several countries to the list, North Korea and Venezuela, as well as Chad, I believe. But talk a little bit about the latest tweaking of this so-called travel ban, I think more accurately this immigration pause, but particularly as it relates to trying to restrict the migration to this country of people who are hostile to us.
Well, that's exactly the point of these executive orders that the president has been trying to get enforced over these last several months. Unfortunately blocked previously each time by activist judges who do not seem to view the threat the same way the president and many of us do. And that threat, just as you say, Frank, is exactly from those who would come to this country, whether on an immigrant or a non-immigrant visa, as an immigrant or as a refugee, with less than 100% intent to abjure and renounce allegiance to every other legal system or system in the world, including Sharia, and rather to pledge allegiance only to the U.S. Constitution. And until we can sort out how to vet, how to do background checks for people on that basis, extreme vetting is what the president called it on the campaign trail, then we really do need a pause in our programs.
We do indeed. One of the things that, as you know, Claire, we've done at the center, in addition, I should have mentioned it earlier, a letter signed by 45 experts on this whole issue of the Iran non-compliance question and the need to jettison the JCPOA, which you can find at securefreedom.org. There's also a link there to a briefing that a number of us put together for the Supreme Court, a so-called amicus brief, that makes the case that the president is looking ultimately not to simply pause immigrants coming here, but to ensure that those who do come are, as you say, Claire Lopez, carefully vetted. He said extreme vetting. Our view of this is that there should be a filter that specifically looks for that proclivity that you mentioned a moment ago, Claire, namely an adherence to Sharia, a desire to see it triumphant in this country as well as elsewhere in the world, a very problematic, indeed quite dangerous sort of feedstock for jihadism and threats of various kinds to those of us who would not submit. Claire, we're going to talk more about all of this on the other side of a quick break. When we come back, we will specifically discuss how the civilization jihad is working in this country and in Europe and elsewhere to silence free speech, that and more, with Claire Lopez, the Vice President for Research and Analysis of the Center for Security Policy, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Claire Lopez. She is a 20-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency's clandestine services. She knows her way around the world of the deep state, I think it's fair to say. She has been very active in protecting our national security outside of the government as well, including these days as the Vice President for Research and Analysis at the Center for Security Policy. She is the editor and the driving force behind over something 16, 17 monographs and books that include the one that we co-authored, See No Sharia, and I'm very pleased to have her with us. Claire, we were talking about jihadism. We were talking about the extent to which it migrates into countries like ours, why extreme vetting or the kind of ideological filter that we've recommended to the Supreme Court needs to be applied. Would you talk a little bit about what I think of as the sort of leading edge of the civilization jihad at the moment? You saw it up close and personal in Warsaw, Poland last week. Tell us a little bit about this front in the war for the free world, the assault on freedom of speech.
Exactly, Frank. You know, I really think that this is, as you call it, the leading edge of the civilization jihad in this particular phase of the Islamic movement against the West and against Western Europe, more specifically, and against the United States, too. I was in a couple of places over these last couple of weeks. The first place that I went was Toronto, Canada, to join Canadian Citizens for Charter Rights and Freedoms in a conference on the 10th of September in defense of free speech in Canada, where a motion called M103 was feared and is now seems to be happening, that legislation, actual legislation, would flow from that to restrict free speech in Canada if it is critical of Islam. The same thing was very evident at the September meeting of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, where colleague Chris Hull and I from the center attended this meeting of the Office for Democratic Institutions and Human Rights, which is a subgroup, a sub-department, I guess, if you will, of the OSCE. Those 3-4 days were enough to see how far gone the hard left in Europe, which leads this organization, has come in terms of the willingness to suppress free speech, to actually criminalize free speech if they can somehow call it hate speech, which has no specific definition, but that's the whole point. It can be tailored to whatever they want. And the point of it was to, in fact, criminalize all criticism of Islam, thus bringing Western European countries under rule of the Sharia law on slander.
In effect, submitting to Sharia blasphemy restrictions, isn't it? Claire, unfortunately, it's not just over there. As you know, I think probably during some of your travels, the United States Congress enacted into law with the president's signature something called PL-115-58, which is, I guess, kind of like this Canadian M103, the precursor to legislation that would, it appears, infringe very directly on our constitutional freedom of expression. Talk a little bit about that resolution and where it leaves us at the moment.
Well, exactly. I think that's a very good comparison you just made there, Frank, between that resolution of our U.S. Congress, which again is not legislation that leads to an act or a bill becoming law, but rather a precursor, precisely as M103, a motion in the Parliament of Canada, was a precursor to efforts now underway in Canada to formulate actual legislation that would become law and restrict Canadians' free speech, which, by the way, just like in our Constitution and Bill of Rights, is enshrined in the Canadian Constitution, what they call the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, the freedom of speech and expression. And yet, by using this ploy of legislating against hate speech, which again is a squishy concept with absolutely no fixed legal definition, but again, that's the whole point because it can be tailored and used as the proponents will. But this kind of legislation now looks to be making inroads right here in the Western Hemisphere and in Canada and the United States as well.
Very alarming. We appreciate what you and Chris Hull were doing to try to resist this trend in the other parts of the Organization of Security and Cooperation in Europe's member states. And also, we appreciate, of course, the clarion call that you're making about the danger that we face here as a result of this concerted effort to silence us. Claire Lopez, let me ask you about one other topic. We spoke about it earlier in the program with Douglas Feith. I'd be interested, having just returned from Europe, in your thoughts about this outcome of the German elections yesterday, and specifically this party known as the Alliance for Deutschland, or Germany, namely the AfD. Doug was rather critical of some of its individual members and their comments, making the point that, you know, if you don't find a legitimate way to accommodate national sentiment, the desire, as Donald Trump talked about so eloquently at the UN, for sovereignty and the preservation of your own culture and state, that you will find more extreme forces coming to the fore. What is your view of this group, the AfD? Is it, in fact, an extreme group, or does it simply seek to resist this Islamist domination brought to it in no small measure by the large numbers of refugees admitted by Angela Merkel?
Well, in these elections, which just finished, the results giving Frau Merkel her fourth term as chancellor in Germany, the party that's called the Alternative für Deutschland, AfD, came in third, which was an unexpected result. But I think it does reflect what's going on more broadly, not just in Germany, but elsewhere in Western Europe, in countries where the elites and the leaderships, political and others, have decided that allowing in hordes of unaccompanied fighting age Muslim men who have absolutely wreaked havoc in some of these countries in terms of the crime rate, the elites have considered that a good idea and party policy. And indeed, Merkel's party did take the elections again. But the rise of these other parties, the AfD, for example, for the first time garnered nearly 13%. And so these parties are rising, I think, indeed, as a result of the backlash from ordinary people, ordinary citizens, who are appalled and frightened at the results of these, you know, unregulated masses of immigrants coming into their country.
And Claire Lopez, just very quickly, because we're almost out of time, how would you characterize the extremist quotient, if you will, of this party, the AfD?
Well, you know, it is termed, they call it in the media and so forth, a far-right party. I'm not quite sure how that term corresponds with how Americans would think of far-right, but their basic platform essentially was in opposition to Angela Merkel's policies of allowing in so many Muslim migrants and the damage that they are doing to the German country and populations there, small towns all over the country as well as elsewhere in Germany. So I don't know that far-right or extremist is necessarily a description that would fit the way we would think about them, but I think what we can think about them is perhaps populist and a response to, you know, popular opposition to Merkel's policies.
I ask in part, Claire, of course, because this kind of plays into the idea that such people need to be silenced, which is the issue we were just discussing with respect to the assault on freedom of speech. Claire, again, thank you for the work that you do here at the Center for Security Policy to try to resist the snuffing of our freedoms, as well as to protect us most especially from the Sharia supremacist threat. I I hope you come back to us again soon, and that the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.